Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Roth Cheese, a trailblazer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people who prepare our meat before it reaches our plates. We hear from whole animal butchers, the brains behind a meat vending machine, California cattle ranchers, and a master of charcuterie who isn't using meat at all.
Like a smoked and grilled center stalk of the broccoli, and then it gets finished with some mustard, barbecue sauce, and sauerkraut.
Ranching and farming being as difficult as it is, you know, it's just one thing after another, and at some point you just give up.
I had a wild idea that if I learned butchery, maybe I could start to be kind of a link in the supply chain.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and it's time for our monthly roundup with the amazing Leah Douglas. For those of you who have not been tuning into my regular updates with Leah, she is a journalist who covers food and agriculture from Washington, D.C. She focuses on corporate power, consolidation, regulation, big business, and political economy as they relate to food, agriculture, labor, land, and the environment. She is currently the associate editor and staff writer at the Food and Environment Reporting Network. And Leah was the 2020 recipient of the National Farmers Union Milt Haeckel Award for Excellence in Agricultural Reporting, very well deserved, and was a member of the 2019-2020 cohort of the New Economies Reporting Project Finance Solutions Fellowship. Welcome back to the show, Leah. Thanks so much for joining us to shed more insight on what we have been covering low these months now. Kind of hard to believe. It's really been about 6 months since we've been talking about the impact of COVID on food processing, food workers, whether farm or, in our case, mostly we've been focusing on meat packing. So you've got this fantastic map going, which I know you update on a regular basis. What's new in the map? What's going on?
Sure. Well, the map and the accompanying database are tracking COVID-19 cases and outbreaks in the food system. So that includes farms and farm workers, food processing sector, and meatpacking and meatpacking workers. And cases are still ticking up in all of those sectors. The pace has leveled off a little bit, and I've been spending some time trying to sort of figure out, is that because of a decline in cases or because of a decline in data reporting on the part of public and private sectors? So that's sort of an open question, but we're still seeing, even with those data obstacles, cases rising. We're approaching 60,000 cases across the three sectors, and over 250 workers have died as of September 21st, the most recent update.
Wow. And I was digging into some of those graphs and charts that you have. I really recommend people go to the Food and Environment Reporting Network website and look for Leah's map, because it really is a fascinating snapshot of what is happening in all three, as she says, all three of those sectors, processing, farm workers, and meatpackers, and sort of how cases are growing or not growing as things may be. And one of the other things that I didn't include in our outline today, but you made a point of in one of your tweets of having to tick up the cases in Kansas. Like, suddenly Kansas, the state of Kansas, released all sorts of figures showing the impact of COVID on some of the workers in that state, some of the food workers in that state. And that was quite substantial. And then you alluded to the fact that perhaps they were not going to release those figures again. Can you just kind of refresh me on that?
Sure. So this is a great example of how the data that I'm collecting is really directly affected by the decisions that states make around how they report COVID data in their business sector. So the state of Kansas announced in late August that they were going to begin releasing information about COVID outbreaks by sector, by employer, starting on September 9th. And this was a big departure. You know, we know that there are thousands of meatpacking workers in Kansas that have contracted COVID-19, but that data was difficult to get. And I was usually getting it through news reports and things like that. So not a reliable, obviously a reliable source, but not necessarily knowing when the next update would come. So to have a regularly updating, you know, public database for that information was very exciting to me. So the first round of that information, September 9th, added several hundred new cases to the database to my meatpacking worker count, partially because, you know, a lot of those outbreaks, there just hadn't been reporting on updated case figures. And there were a couple of new outbreaks that I hadn't seen reported elsewhere. So that was, you know, a big step forward in terms of transparency. The following week, when I went to check the website for the update, the data had been replaced with just a note saying, you know, we got a lot of feedback on releasing the data this way, and we're reconsidering our approach, you know, check back for more information in the future. So that's, you know, it's an interesting and unfortunate turn of events you could sort of see that trend happening in other states as well, where, you know, there's a sort of halting steps forward towards transparency, but then either pressure from private industry or other types of political pressure causes the repeal of those transparent reporting practices. So I'm certainly hoping that they're going to resume that and have asked for some questions and clarifications. So we'll see where we get.
Absolutely. Have you observed this? You say that this is the case in a number of states. Where else have you actually seen this going on? I suppose Nebraska has a big plant, has a bunch of big plants. Colorado, in the South, they have all the chicken and pork processing. Where are you seeing this elsewhere?
Well, in terms of the specific, the specific situation of having a new process and then that process sort of being walked back and changed, I've noticed that in a few places. Another place is Arkansas, where, the state of Arkansas had done some pretty consistent high level, you know, data reporting on the poultry industry, where were their outbreaks specifically, which companies, how many cases, and that data was updated actually multiple times a week. Last week, I went to go find that data, and those reports were not there. I asked about it. They said the new report is coming. And today the new report was released and actually has shifted from reporting the specific names of companies where there are outbreaks to just reporting the sector. So you can't go to that report anymore and just see, oh, Tyson Foods has an outbreak. It says manufacturing in this town has an outbreak of so many cases. So that information, I'm told, is available upon request. But there's a difference between, you know, especially for a layperson going to read that report who might not follow up for directly with the ADH, the Department of Health, for more information. That's a big shift. So that's another state. And I'm actually working on a story now that will spell out some other trends like that I've seen.
Oh, I'm looking forward to reading that. So in the meantime, that's very interesting stuff. I'm going to make a note of that for our next phone call next month. In the meantime, your figures, your map was used by both Smithfield and the North American Meat Institute, which, for people who don't know, NAMI is a big lobbying organization for the meatpacking industry. They both used your figures in their public relations pushback against the recent fines imposed by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And in fact, both companies are contesting the fines that they have been given. But I thought it was really interesting that they used your figures to show a decline in the rate of cases. Would you say that that was an appropriate use of your figures? Or were they somehow manipulating those figures to make it look better than it actually is?
Well, I was definitely very interested to see NAMI, the meat lobby, using the data. I'm always pleased when people use the data. And of course, you know, I believe it's very rigorous and, you know, everyone is welcome to use it. I hope it's helpful to all parties. At the same time, NAMI's report on essentially, as you said, the data was used to show, as NAMI put it, a decline in the number of cases that they used as evidence to say, you know, meatpacking companies' preventative measures to keep workers safe are working. We're seeing cases go down. I would really disagree with that finding, and I spelled it out on Twitter as well. Folks can follow up on that. And essentially, you know, the issue is they ascribe some specific spikes in the data to, you know, holiday weekends, sort of drawing the implicit comparison to, well, you know, people are gathering on holiday weekends, that might account for the spikes. And that was, you know, not the reason we saw spikes on those dates. And I delineated on Twitter, you know, what was going on those dates. And essentially, you know, they hadn't checked with me about information like that to sort of clarify what the data was telling. You know, the question of our cases leveling off or going down, as I mentioned at the beginning, is, of course, you know, crucially important. And I'm trying to figure that out as well. But I haven't necessarily gathered the evidence that I would need to make that definitive a statement. And, you know, NAMI didn't present evidence for that either, other than, you know, drawing a conclusion about the data. So, you know, again, I think it's a question I'm trying to answer. But I don't think that their approach was as accurate.
Right. As I suspected, I just wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth. What I failed to say before I brought that question out was the fact that OSHA has finally, after 6 months, come out and levied some fines. And the fines total $29,000, one to JBS for about $15,000 and something, and one to Smithfield for $13,000 and something. I mean, those are so small as to be laughable. What did you make of that? Like, OSHA, like, what happened?
Well, this is really fascinating. You know, those fines were levied for the handling of specific outbreaks at specific facilities. And, you know, with the charge that these companies had not adequately protected their workers from COVID. You know, two of the largest outbreaks in the country are the ones being targeted by these fines. But of course, there are other outbreaks that are comparably large that were not fined. You know, there's a question there about how the fine tool is being applied. And I think, you know, those fines have received a lot of criticism from worker advocates, labor advocates, you know, all types of folks who are invested in the well-being of workers in this sector to say, you know, those fines were not large enough to prompt any type of different action from the companies. You know, and OSHA responded to that criticism by saying that this was the limit of a certain type of fine application that they could use. And then, you know, the former head of OSHA responded to that by saying that they could have used a different fine tool to give substantially higher fines into the millions. So, you know, it's very controversial how these fines are applied. And I think it also opens the question to me of, you know, what are these fines for? How is that fine regulatory tool supposed to be used? Because I think it's, you know, a fair assumption that, you know, a fine of this size is extremely trivial to a company with the margin of Smithfield or JBS. That makes, you know, extraordinary profits. So I can understand the criticism and feedback that a fine of that size would necessarily compel different behavior. So that's another question that I'm exploring as well.
Yes, looking forward to that. I mean, just as a contrast, you note that, I don't know whether you noted this, but you noted on Twitter that Bluebell Ice Cream was socked with a $17 million fine for a listeria outbreak. Now, in that case, it was consumers who got sick. It wasn't the workers. But, I mean, that's one example of OSHA levying what sounds like an appropriate fine to me. And then I also read that the California state OSHA levied a $200,000 fine against one or several of their local processors. So, I mean, the disparity between these fines is kind of breathtaking. And that also made me wonder, like, why does California have its own OSHA? Does every state have its own OSHA? That's just a dumb question, but I don't know the answer, so I'm asking you.
No, it's a great observation. And so many people have also asked me this question of, you know, why do we have a $15,000 fine in one case, $200,000 fine in another case, $17 million in a third case? You know, again, I think it raises a question about the utility of these fines. And, you know, what I said on Twitter about the comparison between you know, the fines applied for the meatpacking plant workers and management of COVID and the fine applied to Bluebell Ice Cream for its management of the listeria outbreak was, you know, in that outbreak, I believe, you know, 10 people were confirmed sick and 3 people died. Of course, you know, horrible tragedy. In these two outbreaks, however, there were over 1,500 workers who were sickened and 10 workers died. So if this was a consistent fine application, you would imagine that the fine for the meatpacking plants would be, you know, substantially higher given the higher toll, human toll of the outbreak, in both cases dealing with the pathogen, spread of a pathogen. So, you know, it raises a question around, you know, how does this, you know, translate into how, you know, the lives of workers are valued in comparison with the lives of you know, consumers who are buying ice right. cream and getting sick. So I think those are all, again, this is an issue that I imagine we'll see more of, more fines coming out, and it'll be very interesting to see how that progresses.
Absolutely. And it does make me wonder, and of course, I read a long ProPublica article that came out, I think last in April or May, about this, but they made the point of saying that there was a lot of, you know, top government officials sort of leaning heavily on OSHA, on various other entities to allow meatpacking to go forward as it was. And I just wondered if OSHA is also being subjected to a lot of political pressure to sort of give hands off to the meatpacking industry. And that's sort of an interesting question in and of itself. Like, why would they be more, I mean, you would think the dairy industry, for example, would like bust a gut over a $17 million fine to an ice cream maker. You know, like, why aren't they also having an attack with OSHA and putting some pressure on them not to levy these big fines? I don't know. It just, the whole thing stinks to me. Anyway, that is my simplistic analysis of this situation. Another thing that I read recently was that in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Smithfield claims that they have spent over $350 million on COVID-related issues, presumably including PPE, personal protective equipment. Is there any evidence that they have begun to better equip or distance or place barriers for their workers? What do you surmise they are referring to when they talk about this large expenditure?
Sure. So I think in the case of meatpacking companies, when they're talking about what they've spent on managing COVID, that can run the gamut from personal protective equipment, installing physical barriers like plastic shields in between workers in the processing mm-hmm. line. It could account for paying for sick time off and enhanced worker benefits. For instance, there were you know, bonuses given out, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, for workers to incentivize workers to come into work. You know, those were very controversial. But I think when I've heard from meatpackers how they're describing their expenses, all of those different types of expenses are grouped together.
Mm, I see. Well, I would say public relations probably figures in heavily. Because, I mean, the workers are not, to my knowledge, aren't getting an awful lot of sick leave pay, et cetera. What about things like their efforts to test their workers? That would presumably come under that $350 million umbrella of money that they've spent on COVID. What do you have any sense of whether testing has been picked up or extended or is an ongoing effort or, you know, any of the things that we would have normally assumed that they would, you know, protocols they would follow in order to minimize the impact of COVID? What do you see in terms of testing? Is that something that is back to business as usual, i.e. like they did it for the first couple of weeks and now they're not doing it so much? Or is this an ongoing legitimate effort?
That's a great question, and it's something I've revisited a few times during the pandemic. And I do, you know, I think you're right that testing is probably lumped into that. You know, when they're talking about $350 million, I'm sure their testing efforts are part of that. You know, it's very difficult to know. It's an unsatisfying answer, but it's very difficult to know where the meatpackers are at in terms of their testing because simply very little information is being shared. We do know that Tyson Foods, which I think we discussed in a prior episode, did roll out enhanced testing for its workers over the summer, saying that there would be, you know, testing available at many more of its facilities and expanding, you know, workers' ability to access that testing. However, I haven't seen any reporting on or reports from the company on, you know, where exactly that's been rolled out and certainly not on the results of any testing. For Smithfield, JBS, Cargill, other large meat packers, they've been a little bit less specific about how their testing is being rolled out. You know, in Smithfield, I know at one point, you know, the company you know, in a response to one of my questions, said testing is available. However, the definition of what available means really depends. And in some plants, you know, workers will report that, you know, it's only available on, for instance, a certain day for a certain shift, certain type of worker, if it's available at all. So I think there's a lot of ambiguity in there that the companies have not generally addressed.
You know, it's just there are so many ways in which the Trump, I'm going to digress for a moment. You'll forgive me, Leah. But there are so many ways in which the Trump administration and the meatpacking industry are kind of one and the same. And one of those ways is the stonewalling and the opacity of what is going on. Now, the meatpackers have always been this way. I mean, it's like Trump took a page out of their playbook. But I mean, they just refuse to answer questions. They just say they don't have to tell you anything. I mean, by and large, wouldn't you agree that that was... that there is a certain amount of parallels to what's going on in the industry that I shouldn't ask you this question. Never mind. I'm just making a statement. Never mind. But just, it just blows my mind how suddenly the administration is able to do exactly what the meatpackers have done for really generations at this point, which is to not cough up any information about anything they don't feel like. I'm just going to leave it there for now. Let's take a quick break, come back after a sponsor drop, and we will resume our discussion about COVID in meatpacking and also the famous guidances, which, it's anybody's guess what those are. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Leah Douglas.
Today's program is brought to you by Roth Cheese, a trailblazer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth has been making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin for more than 30 years. Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses named Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. When you buy Roth, you know their cheeses will always be made with good ingredients, will always taste good, and will always make you feel good when sharing with friends and family. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
So this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're speaking with Leah Douglas today. We're talking about meatpacking. What a surprise on my show. I know I hardly ever talk about that. It is only my favorite subject. And it's not just because I was a butcher for 5 years. Did you know that about me, Leah? I worked as a butcher.
I did not.
Yeah, before it was cool, by the way. I did it in the 80s. 80s and 90s, I guess. But anyway, so one of the things that... when Smithfield and JBS and, you know, the other meat packers were, you know, whinging on about their minuscule fines. And they said, well, you know, how are we supposed to know what to do? We didn't receive any quote unquote guidance from the government. And so they claimed that they were unable to identify what new protocols they were supposed to impose to keep their workers safe. Do you think they have a point with that, or would it just have been common sense to follow what the CDC said, which was socially distance, wear protective gear, and not breathe the same air?
Well, you know, definitely in the course of my reporting, you know, it's been a really universal opinion from many different types of experts that having more specific and required guidance around how the company should be acting to protect workers would be extremely helpful. You know, I think that there's been, again, a lot of ambiguity around how the companies can best take those steps to protect workers, what that means, and what threshold the companies need to meet in order to be adhering to government standards. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're starting to see litigation arise around COVID exposure in many sectors, but this has come up in meatpacking, where, you know, it's a line of defense for the meatpacking industry to say, well, you know, there were only voluntary guidelines provided and we met, you know, the specific threshold. But it's not as though there's a rigorous standard held equally to every company. So I think it creates confusion and ambiguity that we're going to see returning in different ways as the pandemic goes on. And as, you know, workers and employers try to figure out, you know, who's culpable in the spread of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, to be fair, like, it's true, nobody knew what to do. I mean, everybody was blindsided by this. So I can understand the confusion initially. But I did read in follow-up material to that question of, like, you know, how are we supposed to know what to do? That now they, some of them say, I think it was JBS, some spokesman for JBS said that they now exceed what the government protocols are, just as they have learned, you know, along the way that, you know, some things work better than other things. And I'm sure that's true. I mean, who wants to have to keep hiring people because their, you know, workers are getting sick and spreading disease? Anyway, let's talk about that fact that there is so much ambiguity. Who, in fact, is in charge of the so-called guidance? Like, we have plenty of models for what to do if you, and a pandemic hits the poultry industry or the pork industry. You know, like if you know, avian flu rips through the chicken industry, you know, they have a playbook for that. But nobody has had a playbook for a pandemic ripping through workers. So who, in fact, would be in charge of that? Would that, is that FDA, USDA, the CDC, the Department of Labor? I mean, you know, who's writing this stuff? Like, who's thinking about this? And are they, is there any sense of them, of somebody thinking about what to do the next time we have a COVID?
Yeah, this is a great question. So when we're talking about these voluntary guidelines in terms of how meatpacking plants should, you know, respond to COVID and take precautions in the plants, there was a CDC guidance issued early on in the pandemic that set up those voluntary guidelines and thresholds. You know, this is a great point about this is an issue that cuts across a lot of different federal agencies, and particularly in meatpacking, it's not just labor, as you said, it ties in FDA, USDA. And these agencies all have a slightly different posture towards, you know, how they're responding to the crisis. You know, I think one of the difficult situations that this presents is that no one agency is necessarily the agency to turn to around every issue affecting workers in meatpacking plants, for instance, or any food system worker. You know, for instance, none of these agencies is collecting data about how many workers are sick. This is a, you know, an issue I'm obviously very familiar with. You know, I haven't been able to rely on those agencies for any information. You know, I've had, and I don't think that's common knowledge. I've had states refer me to USDA when I'm soliciting data from state health departments about COVID cases. They'll say, well, USDA regulates meatpacking facilities, but that has no bearing on, you know, who's collecting that data. So I think, you know, that this has been a topic of conversation around food system regulation for as long as I've been working in the field, that the fact that multiple agencies oversee different parts of food production creates, you know, already was creating issues and things were slipping through the cracks. And there were different incentives and different pulls on each agency. And in a crisis like COVID, we absolutely, you know, see that extra spotlight that, you know, there's some issues presented when there's multiple agencies involved.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think that the Obama administration confronted Ebola, didn't he assign like a sort of a czar? I hate it when they come up with these terms, but anyway, but you know, somebody who was kind of the overall coordinator. And I'm wondering if that's a position that a future government, you know, federal government should invest in. Because I don't see that these pandemics are going to stop necessarily. And then, you know, we have other sort of medical crises on the horizon, like the loss of antibiotics and so forth that, you know, are ancillary to this. But you know, just somebody who's kind of going to bring back that playbook that they put together and then coordinate across agencies, that seems like something that should happen. I think you should write to Congress, Leah. They're going to listen to you a lot more than they're going to listen to me. Blowhard. But right,
it's a great point too about planning. You know, I'm reminded ProPublica did a big investigation a couple of months ago that, you know, I would direct you know, listeners who are interested in this, where they essentially found that, you know, the meatpacking industry and sector had been told several times, including by federal agencies, to prepare for some sort of pandemic akin to COVID-19. And there had been essentially no major steps taken by the industry to prepare. You know, and of course, COVID-19 was unimaginable to many of us before it began. At the same time, you know, there is, you know, the government had been providing guidance on how to prepare your workers, how to prepare for massive worker absenteeism that could be caused by a pandemic, which is, of course, exactly what happened in March and April. So, you know, that it's not when we think about moving forward, we can also look backward to see, you know, where there was that solicitation of the industry to make those preparations, and they chose not to.
Yes. And how well, isn't that interesting? And then what about, you know, the fact that there is a failure to coordinate? Do you feel like that also has an impact on food safety as well as the safety of the workers? I mean, like I said before, and I may have been in the ProPublica piece that I read that you just referenced, that they have all of these, you know, they've simulated drills with what happens when, you know, 50,000 pigs die, you know, or 2 million hens, which of course we've seen both of those things happen quite recently. But they don't have the playbook for the workers. But does that also have an impact on food safety overall, do you think?
You know, in the COVID-19 pandemic, I haven't seen necessarily a link between the different agencies overseeing the pandemic and food safety. You know, there hasn't mm-hmm. been much indication that, you know, our food has been in some way affected by necessarily, for instance, illness at plants. But I think it goes back to those fines we talked about earlier where, you know, food safety often rings a bell of urgency with regulators and consumers in a way that, you know, I think it probably boils down to most consumers see themselves more reflected in another ice cream purchaser than they do in a meatpacking worker. Of course, you know, many people are also meatpacking workers as well as ice cream buyers, but right. That's not necessarily the way that these issues are framed. And so I think, you know, that lack of coordination or lack of coherency among the fine, right, you know, the application of the fines, yeah. I think spelt, you know, is one of those examples where, you know, we can elevate in some cases the importance of, you know, food safety in the lives of consumers where we might, another agency might have a different approach when workers are on the line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They clearly seem to be very separated in my mind. I mean, I don't see any overlap at all. And let's talk for a second about now that it's harvest season, a lot more people working in fields. We should have talked about this at the top of the show when we were talking about the map. But did you see in the last month an uptick in virus numbers in farm workers? Because I would think now when you have so many more people not necessarily working together in fields, but living together, traveling to and from fields together, I would think that would be a situation that would be ripe for a rise in numbers. Have you seen a commensurate rise?
Yes, definitely. You know, throughout the summer, definitely cases were ticking up very quickly in the farm work sector. You know, as exactly you said, the trends populationally, you know, when we see more people in the fields, more people on farms, migrant workers arriving, that all corresponded to a higher number of cases. You know, farm work is probably the sector where the least rigorous data is available. You know, this is for a number of reasons. You know, farm workers are a very vulnerable workforce. You know, many folks are not citizens of the U.S. It's also a migratory workforce in some yeah. cases. So just from a logistical standpoint, you know, a worker who arrives in a specific state and is tested there, but then moves on. You know, it can be difficult to track, you know, COVID numbers with that type of trend. So, you know, I have been able to get some data, but there's absolutely more cases out there that I wasn't able to track just because of those of that irregular data. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, as the seasons change and farm work shifts across the country into different stages of the season, what will happen in terms of cases rising or falling.
Mm-hmm. Like I could see the Imperial Valley in California and the Central Valley in California becoming ever more of a hotspot, while other states whose, you know, fields might be done for the winter become much less so. It's you know, it's kind of a fascinating exercise. I mean, I was thinking about the transient nature of farm workers. You know, so you have a guy who works on farm A for 2 weeks, then he moves on to B, and then he moves on to C. You're absolutely right in pointing out that there is no way anyone is going to keep track of that guy. I mean, those tests, even if they get tested at every single location, it's almost meaningless.
And, you know, it's just the testing infrastructure was just not set up in advance to accommodate that. And, you know, we've seen in several states real fumbling by the state government to try to figure out how to serve the needs of farm worker populations, you know, whether in California, North Carolina, New Jersey. You know, there's been some legislative response, there's been some executive order response, but ultimately, you know, all of those things have happened too slowly to really have testing available when it was needed and the ability for workers to really rely on government structures and support. And unfortunately, now we're approaching mid-September where, you know, we're in peak season in many places and approaching the end of the season in other places. And, you know, it's not clear that many of those precautions or supports will be more rigorous before the season, before the year is over.
No, I don't see any signs whatsoever. I mean, they, you know, basically, I feel like everything is on hold until November 3rd. I mean, legislatively, except for trying to jam through a new justice. But, you know, aside from that, I don't feel like anything is going to happen between now and November 3rd, which is kind of a terrifying and yet somewhat comforting moment, because on the one hand, you could imagine something awful happening. On the other hand, you know, it's comforting to think that nothing awful can happen because they're waiting to see, you know, who the next president is going to be. Oh, my God. I guess, you know, I was going to wrap this up by saying, how do you feel about the trends overall? Are we more or less marking time, still the same, pretty much the same level? You said meatpacking has slightly declined, but then you also point out that they're also not producing the same transparency in their numbers as they might have done, you know, in previous months. So where do you see the nation in terms of the, you know, sort of farm to fork, as far as the safety of workers goes and the spread of the disease?
Well, you know, I'm definitely concerned right now with the, you know, the fall and winter months. You know, in many parts of the country, we're going into a colder season where, you know, we know that many regions were anticipating a potential or likely spike in cases. And so, you know, I'm closely watching to prepare for possibility of that in the meatpacking and food processing sectors, you know, impossible to predict, but I'm definitely watching that. And, you know, I've been very concerned to see, you know, less reporting, both from, you know, private companies and from states around, you know, data and cases, you know, especially as national attention is pulled away, very understandably and necessarily by, you know, climate related natural disasters and other issues that are plaguing us. You know, this remains a really chronic issue. And, you know, so I'm just continuing to press where I can, especially from states and local governments, to get as much information as possible so we can really try to understand, you know, is our cases leveling off in this sector, or is it being artificially suppressed? Or, you know, are my figures sort of artificially low because the data isn't being reported? So, you know, just encourage folks to keep reading about this issue. And I'm going to keep pressing on that, especially into the fall and winter.
Thank goodness for you, Leah Douglas. That's all I can say. I hope everybody is listening to this and, you know, passing this on to their friends. Because really, without our essential workers, we really do face food security issues going forward on all sorts of levels. And it's a very frightening, you know, time to be in that business. I know I certainly am glad I'm not working in the food service right now, as I had done for most of my life. Anyway, Leah Douglas, I'm going to let you go from there. But thank you so much for joining me today. And thanks so much for the great reporting you do. Honestly, your halo is shining all the way from Washington, D.C., right up here to Rhode Island.
Thanks so much, Katie. I appreciate it.
You bet. All right. Thanks. And thanks for listening, folks. Thanks to my sponsor. We'll see you next week with another show. Ciao for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.